And so we'll begin with that.
Madam Chair, I'll have John Walls go through the offer.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what members have in front of them to look at. Do they have spreadsheets or just the one page?
Just the one page.
Okay, Madam Chair. Beginning at the top of the page titled House Offer Number 2, this includes the house. This is the old one. It appears that the first two items have been agreed upon, that the House removes the FOCs and tax havens. The Senate removed the claiming of additional DISH money. The House is proposing that the Senate remove nursing facilities and ICFMR surcharges and also remove the suspension of nursing facility rebasing. The House includes adopting the Senate's proposal for MA expansion for adults without children below 75% and July 1 effective date. It also includes dropping the children's mental health case management cut, dropping the restructuring of CCO, reduction of $20 million is removed from the House position. Also dropped is the MAEPD premium increase. The House is eliminating its grants to community clinics and FQHCs. It's accepting the two Senate proposals on involving the Department of Corrections and picking up the associated savings. It's accepting the children's mental health specialty cut in the Senate bill. It's accepting the Senate proposal on MFIP family cap. However, this is with the department eating the, without funding the $1,000 in the fiscal note that was provided by the department. Madam Chair, also included is House accepting the Senate proposal on ICFMR occupancy, accepting the Senate's elimination of two chemical dependency grants, accepting the governor's delay of inpatient hospital rebasing, and also increasing our inpatient hospital rateable cut from 4.5% to 6% and using $5.5 million that was on the bottom line of the Healthcare Access Fund to meet all the targets.
Are there any questions?
I have a comment.
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Madam Chair, on the first one, the MA, early MA proposal, we certainly agree that we should start as early as possible. But we are very concerned that in order to get the governor to sign this, there has to be very significant reform in that proposal. And so we're requesting that that we sit down and come up with something that would implement ACOs as quickly as possible.
Well, Representative Huntley, we did have the staff combine the ACO reforms in both the House and Senate bill for the conference committee to look at so that we could have a discussion about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Abler.
Happy Mother's Day. Nice to be together again on Mother's Day. It's kind of an annual event, and it's just sort of special. I have a couple questions. On number 11, that topic, is that a county duty that that becomes? Is that where the money shifts to?
This was an unallotment, and we just took it in the tails.
Oh, in the tails. And okay. And the and I appreciate the Representative Huntley's comments about some reform that maybe the governor could accept this expansion. I'm not sure how much sugar you have to put on top of that to make it sweet enough to, for that office to swallow. The last I heard, there's still quite a hard no on the whole topic, just if you hadn't heard that. And what I talked on Thursday night, which seems like a week ago, about Bill 1 and Bill 2. I'm afraid we're still working on Bill 1. And I ended up talking in the hallways to various people. Given the lack of a global agreement and lack of hardly any agreement, it sounds like globally and unilateral actions coming from the House and Senate toward the governor as they're going to provide offers in the form of a bill and maybe a $400 million tax increase. I don't know if it's in our interest to get caught up in that. And we probably all are because we're on one side or the other. But I hope at some point that the people in this room who care about the programs we're trying to rescue and modify and protect, at the end of the day, can stay afield of that fight. And I don't know if we're going to succeed at that, but that's just my comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler, I believe the Representative Huntley and I would intend to have some discussions with the administration about our bill before it's closed up at some point. But I do believe, at least on the House side, that there are still some glaring things that need to be taken care of.
And Madam Chair.
Before we have that conversation.
Oh. And Madam Chair, and I'm here, I'd like to sign a bill. And you know, I know it's going to be a bill that is going to involve less doing less than we did before, and it's going to involve, I'm pretty flexible on what I could sign. But I'm just here to remind the committee and the public that some of these points are just on the no list. And in the corrections shift, 840,000 is also on the list. I don't know if it's that alone would make it problematic, but it just adds to the list of things that are there. So I just, part of my job, I think, being one of the few minority members here is just to point that out. But I'm in the majority in terms of trying to get something done. So that's my comment.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, as you know, the courts have come down very hard on the governor's on allotments. And so we're not only dealing with the fiscal year 11 budget, we're having to fix the governor's fiscal year 10 problem. In addition to that, we're also trying to fix fiscal years 12 and 13, so we have a huge amount of work to do. This is not just the fix-up bill that normally we do in the second year of the session. We have a huge amount to do.
Any other questions about the House offer? All right, the Senate has an offer to make. Isn't quite as clean as we would like it to be because at 4 in the morning it's not very easy to find people to ask questions about what's in the House bill, but we think you'll get the gist of it.
Happy Mother's Day.
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, on the Senate offer number 2 dated today, among the first group are House positions that the Senate would accept. The first is a medical provider reduction for specialty care. We were not able to confirm last night, or I guess this morning, whether or not that amount included mental health services. Just a few minutes ago, we found out that it does.
Well, it does and it doesn't. They've excluded office visits, but other mental health services of specialty providers would be cut, and that was not our intention. So we are getting a revised number for this. So our number would be a little bit lower here. And we would have to make that up then by one of the positions that we're changing on the Senate side would be a little bit closer to our original position. And we'll talk about that when we get to the bottom part.
Madam Chair and members, moving to the next item, it would be accepting the House position of eliminating the lead-based grants and also accepting the House position on the Minnesota Care Managed Care withhold. Changes to the Senate position would be to reduce the Senate's current 5% basic sliding fee reduction to 2.5%, to reduce the Senate's position on the nursing facility surcharge by half.
And whatever the remainder is on the item about the medical provider reduction, that would change our nursing facility surcharge number.
Madam Chair, the Senate would also propose dropping the moratorium on premium payments to for liability for foster care providers. We would also drop the ongoing medical provider reduction for basic care. And that's it.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, just a minor question.
Ms. Enabler.
Well, we haven't really talked about the lead grants. I actually know that topic pretty well, and I know you know it pretty well. Is that just such a small amount of money it doesn't matter anymore?
What?
The lead grants? Because I think that's, isn't that still?
What we heard was that they're having trouble giving them out, and that you had it in your bill, so we decided we would take that reduction.
Well, given that source, it must be not so bad to do.
Well, it's not Thank very you. Much money either.
Right.
Other questions or discussion? If not, I thought we'd just take a little bit of testimony before we break. Wanted to start with the Department of Human Services. The Senate would just like to get some read on how and whether the department is able to accept the House additional administrative cuts. We did make the governor's recommendation in the GMC bill. So what the House has is in addition to the cut that was already made for them this biennium.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And I would say that it's my opinion that the department would have difficulty in adding additional administrative reductions, especially in the current biennium. I would remind members when I was originally presenting the governor's budget recommendations earlier in the session.
Speak up a little.
When I originally presented the governor's budget recommendation earlier in the session, I mentioned that the reductions that we were planning for 10 and 11, we had started planning for them back in October or November when the governor had announced he was expecting agencies to do a 3% holdback reduction. So we developed a plan which you saw on a budget page that involved 80 FTE reductions and about a 40% reduction in our staffing and 60%, we think, in non-personnel costs. Now that there is less than 2 months left in fiscal year 10 in particular, I don't know how the leadership team at the agency would take additional reductions in the central office in fiscal 10. That's something that they would have to consider. We also have been covering costs for the prior authorization contracts and the MSHO contracts. This is another item which I'm happy to see that both the House and Senate are funding in the tails, but we had accidentally omitted the funding for that in the 10-11 biennium. We have prioritized to conserve money to be able to continue those contracts. In general, however, the department certainly recognizes the difficult situation that the state is in with the budget and that all state agencies face. So I think that our leadership team would take a hard look at the department's work and try to prioritize to accept and manage reductions that we are given on the administrative side. I would like to remind members of the conference committee that a lot of our work is related to federal programs and that we have federal administrative requirements that we have to meet, and that would certainly be a priority decision that the leadership team would take into account. We also work a lot with our county partners, and a lot of that work happens through our systems, as you know. I think that an additional reduction in the systems area is going to mean that we are slower, perhaps, in making changes in our systems. We are not as available to respond to requests for interpretation and assistance from counties, and that in turn is going to mean that the clients that the counties serve are going to be impacted. I apologize that I'm not able to give specific examples of what actually we would cut at the department if the House position was accepted, but in general it would be a difficult cut. We have taken reductions already in the base budget from last session, and then the governor added an unallotment of 2.25% last summer, which again was central office only. This particular reduction is also central office only. So it is certainly challenging. It would be over 10% reductions in the current biennium.
Ms. Rankin, do you have any idea whether inclusion of this budget cut in our bill would have an impact on the governor's willingness to sign the bill?
Madam Chair and Confreys, I do not. I do not have that information to share.
Maybe someone could make that inquiry for us today.
I will take that message back.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions, Ms. Rankin. First, what are the FTEs that are currently with the department compared to a year ago?
Madam Chair and Representative Hosh, I do not have that information at the top of my head. It has been decreasing, but that's, I assume that for this particular item that we're talking about, you'd be focusing on central office FTEs, and that's the part that I don't have in my head. I know that overall our number has been dropping, but a lot of that, as you would expect, is in the state operated services side of our business where we're a provider. Mm-hmm. Can get that information.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rankin, has central office taken any pay reductions or furloughs or taken any actions along those lines?
Madam Chair and Representative Hosh, we are not allowed as an agency to implement a furlough policy. That is something that Minnesota Management and Budget would decide for the entire executive branch. We don't have the authority to do that for ourselves. We have taken FTE reductions, at the last summer as a result of last session's budget cuts. And I would remind members that we continue to be under a hiring restriction where we need to justify hiring folks based on the essential nature of their work. So that has slowed considerably the hiring that we would do.
Representative Hosh.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Rankin, I just have to ask, does MMB or DHS have a kitchen table?
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, I can't speak for MMB. DHS in the central office does not have a kitchen table.
Maybe we should get one.
Any other questions? Representative Huntley?
Well, Madam Chair, since I'm not chairing today, I can say what I really think. And, Ms. Rankin, this is not aimed at you, but as you shrink down the department, I hope you don't do what we heard yesterday, was that you that your department does not have the time nor the staff to deal with anybody outside of the metro area.
Any other questions?
Mr. Madam Chair, I think Ashton wants to offer a comment, but I was talking to them in the back. But I think it's important to recognize that you can't do work with nobody, and that's obviously the case.
I would tend to agree with you, yeah. Representative Blair. in response to Representative Huntley's comments, you know, all these people that work in the Department of Human Services are just doing what their boss tells them. So I don't think the line staff should be blamed for any inappropriate actions in regard to the GMC bill that the department may or may not be taking. Are there other questions or comments? Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson, and I'm with AFSCME Council 5. Should I find myself in the uncomfortable position of filling in for my colleague Mark McAfee today. What I lack in the knowledge of his ability to explain our concern for the amount of cuts that are happening, I want to pass on our great concern about the matter of these cuts and our ability to deliver service. I think actually was well said by the department that these cuts are going to be very hard to manage, particularly in the SOX facilities. So to take an opportunity to express our concern about the level of cuts and the ability to continue deliver servicing around the state at these levels.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thanks for being here today. Just one last comment, and that really is kind of directed at Representative Thiessen, because he seemed kind of shocked that the Senate had included tail savings for the unallotments to the central office. But these cuts that the House has are cuts that haven't been made yet. Taking tail savings for unallotment cuts that were made last summer seems to me to be a reasonable thing to do. We're not going to be filling those positions again. Let's move on then. We have a little bit of a comparison about what's going on in the two bills and the governor's recommendations in the area of mental health. And Ms. Abderholden has been gracious enough to be willing to share that with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just thought I'd kind of go through some of the cuts that are being proposed in the House that are different than being proposed in the Senate. I'll skip the children's mental health case management since that was added this morning. The school-based mental health funding is being totally eliminated for both this rest of this fiscal year and the next two fiscal years. This program has provided mental health services to over 6,000 children. Half of them who have never received services before. And these grants
also... eliminated where?
Do you want the line number? Or
no, I want you to be more clear.
Oh, 4 points...
But we're talking Governor, House, Senate. There's three places this could be cut.
The House is the only one that proposed to eliminate the $4.7 million for fiscal year 2011 and $9.540 in 2012-2013. And it was not proposed in the Senate at all. And again, this serves 6,000 children. They leverage $2 for every dollar of this grant, so it's even a greater loss in funding. That would be closer to $11 million for this next fiscal year. They also the adult mental health grants It's the governor did not propose any cuts in this area. The House proposed $6.2 million for 2011 and $12 million for the next biennium. The Senate did not propose any cuts, and we did receive already $7.7 million of cuts in this area under the GAMC bill. And the Adult Mental Health Grants Fund, community support programs, drop-in centers, adult day treatment, that type of thing, supportive housing. The Adult Evidence-Based Practices Grants, the governor did not propose, nor did the Senate, any cuts in this area. The House proposed for this the rest of this biennium $750,000. This funds in the rural areas our assertive community treatment teams. The ACT teams are very difficult to carry out, you know, in really carrying out the true model, the evidence-based practice model, because of the population problems. And so they kind of, you could call it an ACT light team, in terms of it still provides intensive case management to those people, which reduces inpatient hospitalizations and things like that. And that's 100% of the program. The adult culturally specific treatment grants, which were the contracts were, had just been ready to be signed. There were no proposed cuts by the governor, none by the Senate, and that would be $300,000. And then the regional treatment center alternative grants, there were no funds being proposed by the governor nor by the Senate. And the House proposes 100% reduction for the next fiscal year 2011 of $2.6 million. This funding is kind of a subsidy to hospitals outside of the metro area for people who need extended stays in the hospitals so that they don't have to go to a regional treatment center. And the hospitals that would be affected include Miller Dwan, Avera, Mesabi, Northwest, St. Cloud, Winona, Cambridge, New Ulm, and Owatonna. And Madam Chair, those are the only other thing is the Medicaid rates to Medicare. Bring them down to Medicare, which was not proposed by the governor or the Senate, and that's a $5.2 million cut in 2011 by the House and $4.5 million in the next biennium. And because of the traditional discrimination by the Medicare system against mental health services, for many years, just until recently, and they're not up to 100% yet, the federal government did only allowed about 60-some percent of the cost to be reimbursed. So mental health rates under Medicare have been traditionally very underfunded, which was why in 2007 you greatly increased the Medicaid rates for mental health services. So these cuts would actually disproportionately affect mental health services in the community.
Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, I have a couple of questions and a comment. My first I guess the first one is just a comment, and it has to do with the school-based mental health grants. And I'd just like the record to reflect that I've heard from a number of school administrators from across the state who are concerned about this provision. And as I have given this some further thought, I would just suggest to members that in our deliberations that we consider what is likely to happen in the K-12 budget division. And at a time when we are unable to provide arguably the support that we'd like to provide to our students in K-12, while this isn't the education division, I would argue that this is a hit directly to students in our schools. The next item that I'd like to comment on is the adult EBP grants. And I would just note that I think that that falls largely on Greater Minnesota. Would that be an accurate statement, Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, that is correct.
And Madam Chair, if I could, Ms. Abderholden, on the adult culturally specific treatment, was unclear to me in your testimony, is this something that has started, or is this something that was being implemented? And I'm just wondering where we are with the implementation of that.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, my understanding is that the RFP had gone out, that they had selected the recipients to receive that, and that would have provided outreach not only in the African American community but the Native American and Latino community as well.
So, Madam Chair,
Lynch.
Madam Chair, Mr. Abderholden, then the culturally specific treatment provision, while the RFP has went out, that hasn't actually started.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, that's correct. It has not yet started.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just one final comment. Ms. Abderholden, the RTC alternative grants, again, I think that is an area that falls exclusively on the non-metro areas of the state. Is that an accurate statement?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, that is correct. Particularly in areas that do not have a community behavioral health hospital, this was an alternative to that so that we could keep people in their home communities. And Madam Chair, I do have a letter that was signed by many of the school-based mental health clinics about their program and the importance of it, if you would like copies of that.
We'll have it distributed. Are there any other questions? Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just so conscious of how many decades we've worked to include mental health reform and recognizing it as a prevention service. And I'm fearful that as we make cuts to mental health here, we're really taking many steps backwards. I also know that mental health has been one of those poor foster children who has been so underfunded for so many years. We were starting to make some progress in finally providing recognition that the services are essential and that they needed to be adequately funded. But even today, mental health centers cannot stay afloat. They usually need to be subsidized in some way. Many of them need to be connected somehow with a hospital so that their services can be covered. They are always a loser in any market. And so I'm very, very concerned about what additional cuts to mental health will mean.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Sharon.
Just adding on to comments, really. I know that when we're looking at these cuts, we know that these grants for the culturally specific treatment programs have not actually, we wouldn't be taking an action where money is already being spent, but I can tell you that this is a real problem, that we have a number of persons with very different cultural perspectives that experience mental health problems. And we see the consequence of our ineffectively using our terribly westernized thought process in addressing these culturally specific white Western kinds of thought processes to these culturally specific groups are ineffective. And it has its consequence, as Senator Prettner-Solin was saying, in the long run in terms of other costs and other expenses in corrections or in the jails because they're not finding a portal or a entry into the mental health system. So I find that even though it's a small amount of money and even though it's not yet been expended, it clearly is identified as a major issue that needs, that if we could commit some dollars towards it, would have significant long-term positive outcome for us in the state.
Madam Chair, I might, Senator Sharon, we hear a lot about just regular health care disparity among our diverse cultures in Minnesota, and the mental health disparity, frankly, is even greater. The stigma surrounding mental illness is, you know, pretty high just in the majority culture, and it's even higher in other cultures. And so this was really an attempt to break that down. And, you know, I think if I might, in 2007, as you know, all of you worked together to really create the largest investment in our mental health system in our state's history, partly because it has been so fragile and it has been so underfunded. And it really was a big deal. And many of these grants that are being proposed in terms of cuts were part of that innovative, you know, legislation that you passed, and barely off the ground, truly. So it really is we see it as a really big hit to the mental health system.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We wanted to have some testimony from folks that are here in concern about the MFIP TANF program. Is there anybody here today?
morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition.
I'm Maureen O'Connell. I'm with Legal Aid.
So we would like to share some concerns, and what I'd like to do is briefly tell you how we see the governor's proposals, the House proposals, and the Senate proposals, what we see in those proposals, and the concerns we have about some of those proposals, and then finally why we're concerned about some of the proposals. The governor proposed to eliminate MFIP assistance to almost 7,000 families who have a disabled parent or child in the household. The mechanism for eliminating that assistance was to count the SSI income that the federal government provides severely disabled individuals and count it against the MFIP grant. In addition, 900 families who use either basic sliding fee or MFIP child care assistance were going to lose or see most of that assistance reduced. What we've seen in the House proposals, and finally the governor proposed to refinance some of the emergency TANF funds that were made available under the stimulus bill, more than enough funds to have prevented the cuts that were being proposed. The House proposals include cuts to the assistance that families who turn to cash assistance receive. Both those who are in subsidized housing would see their MFIP assistance reduced, and any parent who was able to get a job in this economy and move on was going to find their assistance cut off at a lower and earlier level. And the value of assets that someone could have to come on the program during this recession would be reduced. And finally, the funding that workforce providers throughout the state have been using to create short-term skill-building jobs with private sector employers, with nonprofit employers, and in local government was proposed to be cut in the initial proposal, saw a deeper cut as the bill moved through the House, and then yesterday we saw yet another cut, so we see $14 million of cuts in job creation funds. The concerns, and then in the Senate bill, we see no cuts to the assistance, nor cuts to job creation funds. We do see refinancing of TANF funds. Our concerns, I'd like to raise a couple specifics of some of those concerns. I'd like to talk about the exit level reduction from 115% of poverty to 110% of poverty. There are people in this room who experienced the history of creating the MFIP program. And the analysis that was done in the mid and late 80s that concerned both Republican and Democratic members of a bipartisan group was that when parents left the old Aids to Families with Dependent Children program and got a job, they lost all their support at 70% of the poverty level. And policymakers were concerned that if we actually wanted parents to be able to stay in the labor market, we had to make sure they could move above poverty. In Minnesota, as you know, we combine the food grant and the cash grant. It's the combination of those grants that gets someone to 115% of poverty. We are now at the point in Minnesota already, without reducing the exit level, in which a parent who gets a job loses all the cash assistance at or below 70% of poverty. We're back where we were when Minnesota decided to really make welfare work. Parents need to have enough assistance to get above the poverty line, even without another cut to the exit level. Ann Olson from the Minnesota Workforce Council Association could not be here this afternoon. She'll be here a little later today. Her association and my membership share a very significant concern about the deepening cuts for paid work experience. The House of Representatives had a House task force that met before session and held a number of hearings. And we think what they heard in those hearings is the critical and desperate needs right now in Minnesota for anything that will create jobs. And they also heard there are very few resources that the state has available to help spark that job creation. The use of emergency TANF funds to create those jobs has been very effective. between our members and the Minnesota Workforce Council Association members. They can list hundreds of types of employers in which they've been placing people in jobs in Minnesota. Manufacturers, retailers, clinics, boys and girls clubs, local government. I think you've all gotten letters seeing those lists. We think it's the wrong time to make cuts to a job creation effort. And finally, a little bit of explanation about why we're so concerned. So we've all wished each other happy Mother's Day today. And so pardon my dark cloud, but we'd also like you to remember that there are thousands of mothers in Minnesota who are spending Mother's Day this year homeless. More mothers than were homeless 3 years ago. 27% increase in the number of families who are homeless in Minnesota. We think that that connection between families being homeless and the fact that we're offering deep poverty level assistance in MFIP are connected. And we ask you to remember that most of the parents who turn to cash assistance in Minnesota have just lost a job. And they're coming primarily out of four industry sectors. They're coming out of the retail sector. They're coming out of hotel restaurant sector. They're coming out of temp agencies, and they're coming out of the healthcare sector. They're not qualifying for unemployment insurance. They're coming out of jobs that do not offer paid sick leave. They're coming out of jobs that do not offer short and long-term disability coverage. And what we call welfare is a bare-bones alternative to the basic set of supports that any worker ought to have. We don't think anyone would think about cutting unemployment insurance during a recession. We think we ought to look at the very little bit of assistance we offer a set of low-wage workers in the same light. Thank you for your attention.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with Legal Aid. First, I'd like to thank the conference committees in both the House and the Senate for not adopting either the SSI cut or the GA cut. At Legal Aid, we continue to be concerned about the cuts that Deborah has outlined in the House bill. As she mentioned, specifically the housing penalty and the decrease to the exit level. I'm not going to repeat Deborah's testimony. I'm just going to remind the committee that, you know, the grant levels have not increased since 1986 for any of the programs. And at Legal Aid, we continue, our legal aid practitioners continue to tell us how the families struggle with the lack, with just a basic lack of cash in which to meet basic needs. So we are also very concerned, as Deborah has said, about the supported work cuts. As we've learned through welfare reform, many of the families on MFIP share multiple barriers, and the appropriate place for them to begin working is in a supported work environment. And so we would hope that these cuts would not be adopted. Thank you.
Can one of you tell us, my understanding is that the TANF program is up in the Congress for reauthorization, and that there are some provisions in there that would allow us, if we're investing in supported work, to be able to earn more TANF dollars.
Madam Chair,
tell us something about that.
Madam Chair and committee members, two things are going on or not going on in Congress. One, this is the year the Congress would reauthorize TANF. We're not sure they'll take that up, but they have been looking at a one-year extension of the emergency TANF funds that we received under the stimulus bill. The House has already voted an approval of that. We understand that there's quite an effort next week to have the House take up the Senate jobs bill that would extend unemployment insurance, would extend that FMAP assistance that we're all hoping to see, and that there's a strong effort to attach the one-year extension of emergency TANF funds. Those emergency TANF funds are available to this state for three types of spending. to respond to any additional caseload increase we see, and we're seeing some, I believe, and the state staff could say this more accurately, but we've been seeing some small caseload increase in this state during the recession. The funds have also been used and could continue to be used to help counties get increased emergency assistance funds out to respond to families who are at risk of homelessness. And then finally, as Senator Berglund indicated, those funds are available to help us continue and ramp up the short-term skill-building jobs we've been creating.
Do we have to be investing in order to get that money? So if we cut the funds we've been investing, would we be eligible to get those increases?
Madam Chair and committee members, that we earn those funds on a reimbursement basis, and it's an 80% federal reimbursement to match any 20% investment we make. And Madam Chair, if I may add, our concern and the concern that the Minnesota Workforce Council Association shares with us deeply is that we know, as well as you do, that next session is going to be an even tougher session than this. And we also know, as we listen to economists, that there are no predictions that there are going to be significant and dramatic job recovery in the short term. So we believe hanging on to and earning any federal resources we can in order, again, to support job creation wherever we can will be critically needed.
Are there other questions? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's not a question. It's just a point. I want to say the card you gave us last night was very effective, and we actually talked about this on the House side about how this was appreciated. And I hope that you can talk to our colleagues about these impacts, because I don't think you need to convince us on this conference committee some of the inadequacies in our economic support programs. But it's our colleagues that might need some help or a push to show that the stereotypes that were discussed on the House floor when we passed our omnibus bill aren't true. And I encourage you to go this direction, this route, because it's effective.
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh and others, thank you. We'd like you to know that it was our faith-based volunteers from our network who made these, and they have made many others, so we will get those out. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of pick up where Hosh stopped, I do know, talking to some of my colleagues in the House, that they didn't the provisions that the House brought forward weren't anything that made them dance. They were just trying to make trying to balance a bill out. As you suggest, next year, this is going to be easy. This year's bill is like a practice run for the beginning of a warm-up for next year's work. And I I've thought about six different scenarios of what next year looks like, and none of them are any good. So could you help us, help me as I look at the House brought forward, I think, at least three proposals, the MFIP reduction of 115%, the housing thing, and then this workforce thing. Could you help me decide, if I was going to rescue one of these, can you tell me which one you'd like me to rescue of any of them?
Madam Chair and Representative Abler and committee members, we understand very much how tough it is to do the job you do, and we also, to Representative Hosh's point, understand that the legislators who walk in this room are committed to doing as good a job as possible and care as much as most of us watching you in the room about what ends up in these final decisions. That said, I think we also shared with legislators last week a spreadsheet that reminded legislators, as tough as your budget decisions are, the parents who've lost work and have no income coming in are trying to balance a budget that is even uglier than the task in front of you every single day. And what we're talking about is, will we keep that at a deep poverty level assistance level or go even lower? Instead of suggesting a cut, I would ask that as long as there's federal money, then particularly emergency money that was sent to the states to prevent having to make these sort of cuts during a recession like this, that before we refinance any of that money, we hold together the assistance we're offering, and if we can do that, see if there's still some of that money that helps you plug some other holes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Ms. Slick, I know I gave you a hard question, and you answered it very well. But that's the kind of choices that we're facing, and I'm just going to tell you, as I talk to people who care about firefighter jobs on the local government aid from Minneapolis, they sat in my chair, you sat in my chair. They all sit in the same chair. I don't know how that works, but they sit there and they say, yeah, but you can't do this. Oh, I agree, I can't do that. And I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I can't do this to nursing homes, can't do hospitals. We're dead broke. And so my urging to the, not just to you, and you know I've had this talk with you when you were there, is that we have to find a way to do just as good a work in different ways to redesign everything. And we don't have an easy time resigning stuff because no one wants to change anything. They just want their program to go on the way it was. They want the same money and a little bump for them because their need is not, and I'm just picking you as a, it's nothing to do with even your spreadsheet. But in this budget, we are struggling to cut $114 million, which is pocket change to the deficit we face, about $3 billion. And there's tons of politics here, and you can have all that. I'm just here to find a way to get this thing to work this year and next year, and I hope I get reelected. Maybe I don't hope I get reelected to come back and face next year's stuff. But to the audience and to the people you represent as the principals, go back with a message. We have to do something different. We have to go after clinicians who are doing bad work, that are the small minority that we talked about last night, not just dentists, but chiros, physicians, whoever, and not let them be in our state programs. We can't have them anymore. There's no time. We can't have inefficient, ineffective programs that don't do anything helpful. We have to pick something to do that is truly effective, and Ms. Schlicky just gave me a step up to that. And so, you know, we're going to balance a budget by tomorrow that I don't think is going to get signed. We'll be here on Thursday working on this again. But as the interim goes on, I hope we can find ways to do just what I said. I know the two chairs are committed to that. I know all the members of the conference committee are, and I'm just trying to drag all of you in with your principals to come along on the ride, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler, you know, I'm not sure how it is in the House. It's been a while since I've been there now. But
it's different, Madam Chair.
But I know that in the Senate, our colleagues expect us to provide the leadership in this conference committee to do the right things. And since they don't get to amend our conference committee report, in fact, they're counting on us to provide the leadership to do the right thing and bring back a bill that we recommend to them. And the Senate has balanced the budget without making these cuts to poor families. Now, I'll grant you, we didn't have money to fund food shelves. But we think the first priority is to make sure that families who are poor don't get poorer and need a food shelf. And so we're just thinking that maybe we should be reexamining some of these decisions before we make those important recommendations back to our colleagues. Representative Huntley.
Madam Speaker, we had testimony in our committee about a nursing home that often has one person at night for 62 beds. So we are making some very tough choices.
Representative Huntley, the Senate hasn't cut nursing homes in our bill in order to not make this cut. I mean, I don't understand. Are there other questions for these ladies?
Well, Madam Chair, this isn't a question either, but since we're all kind of talking about change or not making change or how we can do it, I just want to really urge people, and Representative Abler, we're going to have a different governor next year. There might be all kinds of opportunities that we're not able to talk about right now, or there may be less, you know, but I think we should keep that in mind. and we don't have a veto-proof majority in the House. Maybe that'll change, too, hope in the right direction.
Other questions for these ladies? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wondered if there's some folks here from representing the nursing home industry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, Jen McNerney with Aging Services of Minnesota and Long-Term Care Imperative.
We had had some testimony in the Senate regarding the nursing home surcharge as opposed to cuts that the governor had made in his budget.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought it might be helpful for the whole conference committee to hear your view on whether cuts to nursing homes or a nursing home surcharge would be preferable. And as you know, our latest offer has reduced the surcharge that the Senate had in their bill by about half.
Correct. Very briefly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the testimony in the Senate was that given the option of the governor's cuts or an increase on the surcharge for nursing homes, we preferred the surcharge. And that, in brief, was the testimony.
And could you just tell us a little bit about how it's structured so as when you have vacant beds or if you have a Medicare bed, how that would affect you?
Sure. We'll defer to Ms. Cullen.
Yes, Madam Chair. Patty Cullen. The surcharge has a payback mechanism in the Senate bill that essentially most facilities will be held harmless because of the divisor used in the calculation to pay back. The surcharge works that you pay a surcharge, you get the federal match, and then you get paid back on a per diem basis based on a certain divisor. And the formula used in the Senate bill was a 0.8 divisor, which means you could have 20% of your beds vacant at any time or with Medicare third-party payers and be held harmless. And matter of fact, if you had less than 20%, you would get back a little bit more than you would be paying out in a surcharge, so there would actually be a little positive on that side. The only facilities that would see a little bit of a fiscal penalty would be those that had greater than 20% of their beds either vacant or using Medicare third-party payers. And in some cases, the last time we had a surcharge increase, some of the facilities took the option of the bed layaway program to remove the beds from active service to layaway service so they could reduce the fiscal penalties.
Are there any questions? Representative Huntley.
I would ask them to comment on the housing with services changes.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, as we also testified in the Senate, we were opposed to the mandatory transitional consultation proposal that would require all potential housing with services tenants to go through a certification process before signing a contract for that establishment, and that was regardless of whether they were private pay or on medical assistance. We also testified in opposition to the 5% rate reduction to elderly waiver customized living and 24-hour customized living.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify because I know that I've certainly got a lot of inquiries on that particular proposal.
Mm-hmm.
That is a Senate position. And I think that it's important for the record to reflect that after the consultation, there's nothing in the consultation that doesn't allow for that individual to ultimately make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have perhaps lost sight of that in some of the discussion. So I think that patient choice is still very much a part of that discussion.
Other questions? Representative Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I just either witness and on this consultation thing, when someone else is paying for something, they have a little responsibility to kind of watch the money. And why is it? I'm kind of mixed on that issue. And the House didn't have it, and I haven't heard a lot about it. Why is it a bad thing for us to ask somebody who's going to be taking advantage of state-paid services to make sure that that's the right service for them to get? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a robust brochure. That's how I see it. But maybe I'm wrong. Can you just? I'm not sure what some of my colleagues will say about it, but I'm just asking the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, in essence, that already happens for individuals who are going on medical assistance or seeking to seek eligibility for medical assistance or elderly waiver.
and it's the long-term care consultation. In addition, any individual who goes to a Housing with Services establishment is given the number for the senior linkage line now so that they could call and discuss their options, again, regardless of their ability to pay. Any individual going to an assisted living is given their uniform consumer information guide that does lay out that that lays out information about the service. So that does happen now. And to Senator Lynch's point, it's a problem with telling somebody they need to have a certificate that they would need before they sign a contract in a private exchange. And then the provider would need to keep that certificate on file to say that that person, that individual actually went through that counseling. So the individual could still move into that establishment, yes. But that it does create an additional barrier for somebody that we think is fairly significant. And we believe that there is a lot of information already out there now that individuals are able to take advantage of if they choose. So, I don't know if...
Representative Abler, I think our feeling is that in spite of the testimony, not as much is being done as could be done, or we wouldn't have a fiscal savings. And the Senate tends to agree with you. It's not just people that are on medical assistance, but people that are near to spending down in one of these facilities and then becoming in need of medical assistance that we're concerned about.
Madam Chair, what was the savings? Was it a million or just a ballpark?
I can't remember. We have the line, but the line has a couple of items in it, so they aren't broken down, but it's... the total savings for this biennium is 3.9, and the savings in the next biennium is 12.3.
And so, Madam Chair, part of that savings is slowing down the spend down to get to MA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm just kind of relaxed having a nice afternoon here, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it, you know, conceptually it seems like there, as we look forward to next year, everything we do, we have to make sure that it's the right thing for the right person at the right time. And you run into a little freedom edge there, too, but when what you're going to get is paid for by people who aren't you, maybe you paid in over your life, but, you know, it's. I think it's an interesting thing to talk about, so thank you.
Well, and Representative, part of our concern is that if we don't do it this year and we do it next year, then we start back with 3.9 and we don't have the 12.3.
Yeah.
Other questions? Thank you, ladies. We're going to take a break now, and we would be expecting a proposal back from the House, and if you could give us an idea of what time you think you might be ready to do that.
Madam Chair, we would aim for about 3:30.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll be in recess then until 3:30.
You don't have to do any checking. It's all money, right?
Yeah.
See what.
Sorry.
They will bring that back.
Oh, so he's talking about recessing the public meeting so that in the meeting.
We're at an impasse.
Okay.
The house.
She's waiting.
Ability to earn. We were working.
Hello.
They may have to go on another person.
breaks my heart.
But there's a cost because you have to provide more, more child care. So
have you told the house?
Get my note. Awfully agreeable, huh?
Doing that if we are able to not do it and pay for it.
That scares me. I'm going to get your cell phone number and give you.
Okay. I will let my folks know.
If you're right, I'm happy to.